I'm not encouraging the use of credit, but I want to use this as a part of our object lesson this morning, because this particular credit card has a title on it, and it says Everyday Rewards. Everyday Rewards. And what happens is when you use this, you can earn rewards. You can earn airline miles, or you can earn prizes, or you can actually earn money back. But did you know that it is possible for us to earn eternal rewards? It's possible for us to earn eternal rewards. And one of the things that we're going to discover this morning in the parable that we're going to look at is that money can actually be an instrument to that end. Well, we're looking at a parable again, and the parable that we're looking at is the parable of the shrewd manager. Now, you remember that parables are a specific way of teaching. Jesus has secret teachings, and he has treasures that are hidden in his parables. And what a parable comes from two Greek words, para, which means alongside, and balo, which means to throw. And the idea is that you throw two ideas down, one right next to the other, and by comparing them, you get insight one into the other. When Jesus taught in parables regularly, and he taught in parables so often that one day they asked him why he taught in parables. And this is what he said in Luke 8:10. He said, "The knowledge of the secrets of the kingdom of God has been given to you, but to others I speak in parables, so that though seeing, they may not see, and though hearing, they may not understand." In other words, he intentionally used parables to kind of hide some of the truth. Now, I don't think that Jesus' intention was that he didn't want people to discover what the truth was in the parable. The truth is that he wanted them to seek harder for it, because when you seek something that's hidden and more difficult to understand, you value it more. When I play hide-and-seek with my granddaughter, my intention is not to hide so that she can't find me. My intention is to make her look for me and to be surprised and excited when she finds me. And I think that's what Jesus wants to do with these parables. He wants us to dig in, and he wants to be excited when we discover the treasure that's hidden in the parable. And so this morning we want to look at the parable of the shrewd manager. And it has been our tradition as we read through the scripture to stand up. And so I'm going to ask you to stand up. And I'm going to read through this parable for you this morning. And listen and see if you can get some of what's going on here, all right? Here it is. Jesus told his disciples there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. And so he called him in and asked him, "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be a manager any longer." Well, a manager said to himself, "What shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm too ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses." So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, "How much do you owe my master?" 800 gallons of olive oil," he replied. The manager told him, "Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400. Then he asked the second, "And how much do you owe?" 1,000 bushels of wheat," he replied. He told him, "Take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. "For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much, and whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." Lord, we ask this morning that you will help us discover the hidden treasure in this parable. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen. You may be seated. Now, I want to ask a question this morning, which I think is appropriate for all of these parables and our theme, and that is, what is the treasure that is hidden in the parable of the shrewd manager? And I have two treasures that I've picked out of this parable today that I'd like to share with you. Number one, treasure number one, is that a heavenly welcome awaits those who use money shrewdly. A heavenly welcome awaits those who use money shrewdly. And I'm not talking about just any use, any shrewd use of money. Jesus has in mind a particular shrewd use of money that results in a heavenly welcome. Now, this parable of the unjust steward, as some people have called it, or the shrewd manager, as the NIV says it, has been called one of the most difficult parables to interpret. In fact, when I was talking to Pastor Ron about what sermon to do, what parable to do, he said, "What are you thinking about doing?" I said, "Oh, I don't know." He says, "Why don't you pick a hard one?" I said, "Well, I've been thinking about that shrewd man. That's the one I had in mind for you." He said, "It must be the will of the Lord, you know." So this is the one we're going to do. And it's a little tricky, I have to admit. But one of the reasons that people find difficulty in interpreting this parable is because it seems to maybe commend somebody who's kind of a rascal. It seems to almost verge on commending somebody who's dishonest and commending the dishonesty. Now, if you look closely, you'll realize that there's no commendation of the dishonesty. There's a commendation of the shrewdness. But it kind of borders on that. And yet it's not uncommon for Jesus to use some of these kinds of characters in his parables. Some unsavory fellows, if you will. You remember in one of the parables there was a lawyer. And this lawyer is characterized by the fact that he doesn't care about anybody. And he won't even answer the door if somebody keeps knocking on it. But finally, this widow keeps knocking and knocking, and he finally opens the door and grants her wish. There's another one where a guy goes and he's looking in a field and he finds this treasure, and the field belongs to somebody else, and so he figures out, I know a way to get this treasure. I'm going to go buy the field. Treasure is worth more than the field is. So he goes, buys the field from the other guy, and takes the other guy's treasure, if you will. And so he has some of these kinds of characters in his parables, but this is probably... I would call him the one who is probably the worst character, but not the only unsavory one. And in fact, Barclay, as he describes this parable, he says, this is a parable about a bad man's good example. All right? So, second reason that there's difficulty in interpreting this parable is because there are a lot of complexities in the details. And up on the screen, we'll have a couple of those complexities. You got those? Click, click. There we go. Like, was the master a partner in crime? And what's the different types of managers that there could be? And what kind of debt was this? Because there were different kind of debts. And if these people were landowners, what kind of landowning arrangement did they have? Now, I'm not going to take time to go through all of these this morning, like I did last night. Instead, I just want you to be aware that what happens is if you don't get these pieces right, what happens is sort of like a puzzle. You try to fit one in and another one pops out and doesn't seem to fit anymore. But instead of going through all of these, I just want to give you a summary statement from a man named Kenneth Bailey, who has a book called Poet and Peasant. And he goes through page after page of these difficulties, and this is how he summarizes the background of this parable. And this is what he says. In summary, clearly the most probable setting for the parable is that of a landed estate with a manager who had authority to carry out the business of the estate. The debtors were most likely renters, who had agreed to pay a fixed amount of produce for the yearly rent. So they were renting property, and they paid rent in produce from the property. The steward was no doubt making extras under the table, which his boss probably didn't know about, but these amounts were not reflected in the signed bills. He was a salaried official who, in addition, was paid a specific fee by the renter for each contract. The master was a man of noble character, respected in the community, who cared enough about his own wealth to fire a wasteful manager. So, unsavory characters and the difficulties and complexities of all of the details are part of what makes this parable difficult to understand. And the third thing that might make this parable difficult to understand is that people force the details in the analogy. Many times in a parable, when you throw down one idea next to another, the thing about a parable is there's one point to compare. And we get ourselves into trouble when we make a parable an allegory. And we say, this compares to this, this compares to this, this compares to this, this compares to this. If you try to do that with this parable, you got a big problem. Okay? You need to stick to the main point. And one of the things that I think is interesting in helping us discover what the main point of this parable is the way that this parable is structured. It's actually structured poetically in what has been called a chiastic structure. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever heard about that, but I'm going to try and help you understand it with this little display on the screen. The chiastic structure is based on the Greek letter chi. It's like a big X, like this, okay? And the idea behind it is that in an X, you start here and you end here. You end at the same place that you started. And you move in, and then you move out. So do you see on the display up here the kind of a chi on the side? A, B, B, C, B, B, A. And we start with the master and steward talking about waste, but we end with the master and steward talking about shrewdness. We come after the first talking about waste, we have a problem and a problem, and down at the other end we have solution and solution. But what's in the center of the parable, and what is in the center of the chiastic structure, is that C. In a chiastic structure, the main idea is right here. X marks the spot. And so if we want to know what the key point of this parable is that Jesus is making, we find it in this chiastic structure. And the key idea is, what did that steward think about doing? And you'll discover that when you get to the end of the parable, that's the exact point that Jesus applies to us. What was his idea of what to do in order to solve his problem? All right? So those are the key ideas in the chiastic structure. And the problems. Number one, I've already forgot all the characters. Number two, the complexity. And number three, trying to force too many points. Now, with that as a background, let's go through the parable and see if we can understand what Jesus was saying. We're going to start with stanza one. Verse 1, Jesus told his disciples, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. Now, this man must have been very rich. And you get an indication of that if we understood properly when he talks about 800 gallons of olive oil as being the payment on the crop. How huge must have that olive orchard been? How many acres of olives must have been farmed to produce not only what the tenant got, but what the landowner received as a payment? He was very rich. In fact, I'll call him the head of Eretz Industries. Eretz is the Hebrew word for land, okay? So Eretz Industries. And we know he was into olives because there's olive oil in this. And we know that he was into grains because there was wheat. And those were grown in the center of the nation of Israel. It's possible that he was into other things. If he was down in the south, he could have been into dates or palm oil. And if he had industries up in the north, he could have been into wine. But he was very rich. And he had this manager who was a property manager for him that oversaw some of his tenants who were taking care of his property, and they were paying him a fee on it. And this particular property manager was wasteful. Now, we aren't told how he wasted his manager's money. We're just told that he was wasteful. But we have a little hint, because this parable follows a previous parable. And do you know what the previous one was? From 2 weeks ago. The prodigal son. The prodigal son was wasteful of his inheritance. The exact same word. And he squandered it. So this steward must have in some way been like the prodigal son in the way that he was wasting the resources of his boss. Let's go to stanza number 2, verse 2. It says, so he called him in and asked him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be a manager any longer. I read that verse and I heard this song in the back of my head. Money, 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 money. You remember, recognize that? From The Apprentice, and I saw the face and the finger of Donald Trump. You're fired. You're fired. Now, there's a difference between the firing here and the firing on the show. Because on the show, they're apprentices. And they're working because they want to be given a stewardship and a property manager for Donald Trump. This guy was already a property manager, and he messed up, and he lost it, and he was fired. He's fired on the spot. Now, probably there was a little bit of time between when he was fired and when the word actually got out. And the master said, bring in the books. Bring in the books. And so he thought, I got to do something really fast before those books are brought in and before the word gets out. Got a problem. Stanza number 3, verse 3. The manager said to himself, what shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm too ashamed to beg. I call this verse PFS, post-firing syndrome. Have you ever had that? All of a sudden, you go, I don't have a job. What am I going to do? And we're not talking about a big city here where there are all kinds of jobs. Probably the main employer in the area is this landowner, and he just lost a pretty cushy job with the landowner. So he starts going through the scenarios, starting from the top to the bottom. Well, I can't be a property manager anymore. Oh, no. What if I have to be a farmer? What if I have to actually go out there and dig? Well, I'm too old for that. I'm too weak for that. I can't do that. Step one down, step two down. Oh, man, if I can't do that, what am I going to do? I'll probably be homeless. I'll probably be sitting there with a sign that says, we'll work. Oh, I can't work. Just please give me food. And so he says, I got to do something about this. I got to devise a plan. I at least don't want to be homeless. And then we get to the next stanza, which is the key C point in the parable. I know what I'll do. When I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses. And so he makes this plan, how he's going to make friends with the master's money. And this is the only parallel that we have to make in this parable. And it's the only one I'm going to make. Okay? Stanza number 5. So what does he do? He called in each one of the master's debtors, and he asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 800 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 400. First of all, we see that he calls in the debtors one by one, probably in order to maintain secrecy and to get this thing done before they find out that he doesn't have a job anymore. Second, we see that he said, sign the bill quickly. There's some kind of haste here. And we can probably assume in this story that what is happening is between the time that he brings in the books and was fired, he takes these actions to look out for himself. And probably the people haven't heard that he was fired, and so they assume that he still represents the master. But he probably represents himself as some kind of broker of the deal that reduced their debts. Because I can't figure out any other way that they would be indebted to him to invite them into their homes if the master was the one who was solely responsible for what took place. So he's putting himself in between saying, hey, I really worked this thing out. It's kind of like a foreman in a company who negotiates a Christmas bonus with all of the people. And he says to them, isn't this Christmas bonus great? Isn't our boss great? Man, you should thank me because I worked this baby out, right? That's kind of the posture that he's in. And so he cuts the bills in order to gain affection and build relationship with these debtors because he wants them to take him into his house when he's out of a job. Calls in the second debtor, and he says to him, he asks the second, and how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat. And he replied, take your bill and make it 800. Now, one of the things that we see from the calculations here is they probably weren't percentages. They probably were fixed amounts. And one of the commentators say 500 denarii each, take 500 on this, 500 off this, 500 off this. It's a way to make the calculations real easy and get them done really fast, okay? But again, we see that this was a very wealthy landowner. 1,000 bushels of wheat is the payment. How much would the huge crop have been? So he solves the problem by talking to the debtors. And now, finally, the word gets out. The word gets out, and we're told that the master commended the dishonest manager because he acted shrewdly. Now, I want you to think with me, why did he do this? And I try to put myself in the master's position, and he find out, basically, he was kind of in a dilemma. All right? Here, his representative has gone out to all the people, and he slashed their bills. And he postures himself as having negotiated, but the really good guy that slashed the bills is the owner, all right? So he has a choice. I can tell everybody that this guy was not acting on my behalf and cough up the money, go back to that other contract, and then how are they going to look at him? Probably a little bit of backlash. He didn't have to do it, but now that he did it, he's going to be in trouble if he takes all that money back. So he says, what can I do? I can get the money back, I can put this guy in his place, and I'll ruin my reputation with the people, or I can forget the money, and I can keep my reputation with the people. And he says, forget the money, I'll keep the reputation. And by the way, dude, you were a shrewd dude. You were a shrewd dude. And he doesn't put him in jail, and he lets him go. Kind of a merciful guy. And that's the end of the parable. And then this is what Jesus says about the application of the parable. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Now, I want to go through and I want to talk about some of the key words in here. People of the world, their own kind, the people of light, worldly wealth, when it is gone, and eternal dwellings. I'm not going to spend a half an hour on each, okay? First of all, people of this world probably means those who are focused on worldly activities, okay? They're the ones who are interested in everyday rewards, okay? Everyday stuff, people of this world. And their own kind is probably those who are similarly focused. Who are the people of the light, though? Well, most interpreters look at this, that the people of the light are those who are servants of God and who are followers of Jesus. And we get this from several verses in the New Testament. One is John 12:36. It says, put your trust in the light while you have it, so that you may become sons of light. There's the same concept. Ephesians 5:8. You were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Live as children of light. There's the concept again. 1 Thessalonians 5:5. You are all sons of the light and sons of the day. We do not belong to the night or to the darkness. And so it's possible that the sons of the light are a reference to the people who are the servants of Christ, who aren't as smart as the people of this world in the shrewdness with their dealings. The next phrase is worldly wealth, sometimes translated unrighteous mammon. And the idea that there's some kind of unrighteousness associated with wealth. In the Bible, money is generally considered to be amoral. It's neither evil nor good. But here, the idea is maybe it's tainted in some way, and the idea is that maybe it was gained in an improper way or something like that. And so he's saying in the use of worldly wealth that is exchanged maybe in an improper way or gained in an improper way, they're pretty smart with how they use. It might just mean the money of this world. All right? When it is gone, I think we can all identify with the meaning of that. When it is gone. All right? Any of you got house value? Not anymore. Any of you got stock value? Mutual fund? Not anymore. When it is gone, goes really fast. But that's not ultimately what this is talking about. This is talking about when it's really gone. And when it's really gone is when you die. When you die, you don't have your money anymore. All right? And you're headed somewhere else. And so Jesus talks about when it's gone, when you die, make sure that you've done something so that there are people to welcome you into eternal dwellings, probably a reference to heaven. Okay? So what is this parable saying? Yet Jesus is saying the shrewd manager used his means, his financial means, to secure future well-being on earth. If you were smart, you would use your financial means to secure a well-being in heaven. And how would you do that? Well, he doesn't tell us exactly, but most of the writers and the commentators on this passage say it's by helping out those who are less needy. It's by helping out those who are poor is a way that we invest so that there are people who will invite us into heavenly dwellings. And that's not a bad interpretation because of the parable that follows this. The parable that follows this is the story of rich man and Lazarus, where the rich man didn't use his money the right way. Lazarus is a beggar. The rich man sees him. He doesn't give him any money. When his money is gone and he's died, Lazarus ends up in heaven. The rich man ends up in Hades, and they have this discussion about help out my brothers and everything. But the point is, they change positions. And the rabbis had a saying about this. They said, the rich help the poor in this world, but the poor help the rich in the next. The rich help the poor in this world, but the poor help the rich in the next. Ambrose said, the bosom of the poor, the houses of widows, the mouths of children are the barns that last forever. Remember the story of the rich fool that built barns for this world? Ambrose is commenting on that parable, and he says, these are the places where you can invest, where you'll have an eternal reward. And so here's my paraphrase of this passage based upon this interpretation. People focused only on the things of this life are more shrewd in their dealings with people here than are the servants of God. Hey, use your material resources to make friends. Help those who are less fortunate, so that when you die, there will be someone there to welcome you into heaven. Make sense? Not a bad teaching. Now I want to give you one other possible slant on this passage. And the reason that I want to look at this is because one recent interpreter has noticed that the words sons of light and the mammon of unrighteousness, or people of light and worldly wealth, are technical terms that were used by a group in Jesus' time called the Essenes. And maybe what Jesus was doing is he was using these terms to talk about what the Essenes believed. So let me briefly tell you what the Essenes believed. The Essenes believed that people were divided into two classes by God. There were the sons of the light, and there were the sons of darkness. The Essenes, our group, is the sons of light, and everybody else out there is the sons of darkness. Typical cult, right? Typical sect. All right, that's what the Essenes believed. The other thing that they believed is that they didn't want to defile themselves with doings with the people out there, the people of darkness. And so they separated themselves as much as possible in any way from people that were not part of their group. One of the ways that they separated themselves was they lived in a remote community. And if any of you have ever been to Israel and you visited the area of Qumran, you see where the Essenes lived. I put a picture up here of it. Here you have, over on the right, you have the Dead Sea. And right there in the center, you have a section that's called Qumran, which is where the Essenes lived. It happens to be a very remote area that was away from the main traffic. But it also happens to be a very arid area. And one of the things that we are indebted to the Essenes for is that they preserve scriptures in pots and put them in caves like this one, Cave 4. And this is where we discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls. Okay? So we're indebted to them for that. Another way that they separated themselves, not just geographically, they separated themselves financially. And in their manual of discipline, where these two phrases are used, listen to how they describe what their financial relationship should be with people who are outside of their group. This is what it says. Oh, there it is. No member shall be united with him, the outsider, in his work or in his wealth, lest he defile the member with guilty iniquity. But distance shall be kept from him in every matter. No member shall eat from anything of their property, nor drink from it, nor take anything from their hands except by payment, and all their deeds are filthiness before him, God, and the uncleanness is in all of their wealth. See the mammon of unrighteousness? See the sons of light and the sons of darkness? We're the sons of light. You're the sons of darkness. You have worldly wealth. You have unrighteous mammon, and we don't want to have any financial dealings with you. And so, if Jesus' reference to the people of this light and worldly wealth is a reference to the Essene terms, then what he's doing in this parable is he's drawing a contrast between their idea of separatism and the way that he wanted his followers to be engaged with people who were doing business in the world and not to separate themselves from it. See, Jesus and his followers made friendship with outsiders, people outside of the group and even people outside of the community. He made that a priority. He wanted to help open non-believers' hearts to the message of Jesus' love. And Jesus saw the open exchange of material wealth as a means to the open exchange of spiritual wealth. Does that make sense? As we do business with people in the world, there's an open exchange of financial resources, which opens up the opportunity for us to have an exchange of spiritual things. And so if Jesus was using these terms to apply to the Essenes instead of to his followers, here's a different way that we could read the application of this parable. It would be people focused only on the things of this life are more shrewd in their dealings with people here than are the Essenes, who conduct no business with people outside of their group, hey, use your material resources to make friends by doing business with non-Christians so that when you die, there will be someone there to welcome you into heaven. And so what's the application for us? Well, maybe it's something like this. Maybe the next time that we have a mechanical problem with our car, the first question that we ask should not be, do you know a good Christian mechanic? Or maybe the next time that we have a medical problem, maybe the first question that we ask shouldn't be, do you know a good Christian doctor? The idea being that we create this separate community and we keep ourselves apart from those people out there. Okay? Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with doing business with Christians. Okay? I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. What I'm saying is this. The more we separate ourselves from the people of this world in our business dealings, the less opportunity we have to make friends, more friends, who will welcome us into eternal dwellings. Get the point? So we need to look at our business dealings as an opportunity to create an exchange of money, but also to create an exchange on the spiritual level. Now, either way, if Jesus is talking about helping the poor with our money, or if he's talking about having business dealings with people outside of our Christian community, the same point is made. The singular point of this parable, you can use material resources to gain eternal rewards. Eternal rewards. And one of those rewards is people are going to be there to welcome you into heaven. Treasure number two. Treasure number two is that true riches await those who use money faithfully. Verses 10 to 13. True riches await those who use money faithfully. Now, what Luke does here is he turns from the idea of shrewdness to the idea of faithfulness. This steward was shrewd in his business dealings, but he was unfaithful in the way he managed the property of his boss. He was shrewd, but he was unfaithful. And what Jesus is saying, what Luke is saying, is the most important characteristic of managers is not shrewdness. The most important characteristic of managers is faithfulness. And we see that over and over again in the New Testament. 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 12. It says, moreover, it is required in stewards or managers that a man be found faithful. King James Version. NIV says, now it is required that those who have been given a trust, a steward, that they must prove faithful. All right? Faithfulness is the primary quality that needs to be found in stewards. And so Luke picks this up in verses 10 to 13, and this is what he says. Whoever can be trusted with little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest, like this steward was, with little, will also be dishonest with much, which he was. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, as he was, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? Now here's what he's saying. Unfaithful management loses its stewardship. Unfaithful management loses its stewardship. The manager may have been shrewd, but he was not faithful, and he got the finger, right? You're fired. I'm taking away what you were responsible for. You're fired. Unfaithfulness loses a stewardship. But faithful managers expand their stewardship. Faithful managers expand their stewardship. And there's three ways that that's shown here. The first one is little to much. Little to much. Are you faithful in the small things? Then you will be entrusted with larger things. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And isn't this the way we work? If a person works for us in the company and he does a good job, we expand his responsibilities. If a child at home, when we're raising them, is responsible with the resources we give them, we expand their privileges. We say, can I borrow the car? And you say, how fast was the top speed limit that you hit yesterday in that 40-mile-an-hour zone? 50. I don't think you can drive the car, okay? But if they're responsible in driving the car, then we let them use it more, okay? The idea, little to much. Second way that we expand stewardship, and this is the key treasure number two here, have we been worthy, have we been faithful with worldly wealth, the money of this life, then we will be entrusted with true riches. It expands from worldly management to heavenly management and true riches. Proper use of our financial resources here brings the reward of true riches later. Eternal rewards. And number three, expands from managing another's to managing our own. Those who have been faithful in the management with another's property will be entrusted of property for their own. Have you, if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? Little to much, temporal to eternal, someone else's to your own. A faithful steward has his stewardship expanded. So, what are you going to do with your eternal rewards card? All right? You can earn larger responsibilities. You can earn eternal true riches. You can earn property of your own if you manage your resources here on earth properly and you're a good steward of what God entrusts to you. And then Luke ends with this challenge. No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot love both God and money. One writer said, the man who sets his heart on money, that is in his hand, and therefore finds gifts to the needy annoying, may delude himself in his position as master over his money and of his independence on other men. But in actual fact, he is a slave of money. In other words, I think I have control over it, but I don't give it away. But I'm not in control of it. It's in control of me. A man's true wealth does not consist in what he keeps, but in what he gives away. Now I want to tell you a story. This is a story about a couple that I knew in my former church whose names were Sam and Agovny Brave. They were old. They were in their mid-90s. I met them earlier than that, but Sam had a hard time sitting for a long time, and we had our auditorium was something like this. It had a lobby, and you could go around. We have it all clogged up back there with music stuff, but if it was open, you could walk all the way around this auditorium. So what Sam would do, he would take his walker, and he would walk around on Sunday morning and listen to the sermon because he couldn't sit. And this couple was Armenian, all right? Not Arminian. You know the difference? You go look that up. Armenian is a theological. Armenian is a race. And they had actually come over to the United States during the Armenian genocide. Agovny told me the story of when she saw her father hung as part of that genocide. Now, this couple did not have a lot of money. They lived on their Social Security. They lived in a small home. But there was a man in our church who developed a relationship with them, and he was kind of a financial planner, and so he inevitably asked them a question. He said, Sam and Agovny, what have you done with your estate? What are you doing with your estate? And they said, what estate? We don't have anything. We live on our check month to month. And he said, well, what about this house? Do you own this house? Oh, yeah, we own the house outright. Well, have you thought about what you're going to do with this? No, we haven't, because we don't have any kids. So he discussed it with them, and they made a plan. And what happened is when they died, they gave the house to the church. And Agovny was always interested in kids going to Bible school because she had had the chance when she came to America to go to Bible school. And so she said, we want our money to go to help people go to Bible school. So when they died, the kids from our church went down, renovated their house, the church sold it, took all of that money, put it into a trust, and every year, kids get scholarships to go to Bible college from that sale of Sam and Agovny's home. And this is the beauty of that. They're an example of using worldly wealth to produce eternal rewards. Think about what is being accomplished for the kingdom through the fact that they gave a financial resource to this. And this is the kicker for me. They're gone. And the money is still working back here. They're gone, and the money is still working back here. I think they're an example to us about how we can use financial resources to gain eternal rewards. And I have a question for you. What is your estate plan? You may think you don't have very much, but you ought to think about what you want to do when you pass away. If you don't have a plan, Uncle Sam has a plan for you. Okay? It's to take most of what you have. But there are ways that you can have that money when you're gone, when it's gone, you can have it produce eternal rewards if you make a plan right now and you're shrewd in the use of your money. Second story I want to tell you. Years ago, I went to a camp. It was a weekend experience. And part of this camp was heaping of blessings on us. Great instruction. Great times of encouragement through the weekend. And as we came to the culmination of the weekend, it was the evening and we were going to go into the auditorium where we had been as a group several times for different events. But when we started to the auditorium on this final culminating event in the evening, all of the walkways were lined with these lanterns that had lights in them. It was beautiful. And as we walked into the auditorium, it wasn't empty. It was full. It was full of all of the people that had encouraged us to come to the camp. It was full of all of the people who had been an encouragement to us during the time. And many of them had heaped that encouragement on us because in some way we had blessed them in the future. And I remember walking down that aisle, and I remember looking at all of those faces and the people waving and smiling. And I thought, this is like heaven. This is like heaven. This is what it's going to be like in heaven. And that's the challenge of this parable. Jesus is saying that you can make that happen when you go into your eternal dwellings. There were people on the aisles smiling and saying welcome because you used your money in a shrewd and a faithful way. And so here's my challenge to you and to myself this morning. Consider what you can do with your financial resources to gain not just everyday rewards, but eternal rewards. When you make every transaction that you make financially this week, I want you to think about this parable. I want you to ask yourself, am I using my material wealth to produce eternal rewards? Am I acting shrewdly so that I'll have friends who will welcome me into heaven? And am I acting faithfully so that my master will entrust me with true riches? This can happen to you if you understand the treasure that is hidden in the parable of the shrewd manager.